school's graduation ceremony. So on Sunday, many students marched in their gowns from their graduation to join hundreds of others at a protest outside Milford's town hall. That's Massachusetts. Let's go across the country now to San Diego, where outrage is growing after 20 armed and masked ICE agents in full tactical gear raided a popular Italian restaurant Friday. The agents handcuffed the staff, demanded IDs, arrested four workers. Local residents reacted angrily to the raid, attempted to block ICE vehicles from leaving the scene. ICE agents responded by throwing flashbang smoke grenades at the crowd. Just two examples of communities expressing outrage over ICE raids. This comes as immigrant communities are also pushing back on the raids and arrests. In San Diego, the Union del Barrio is conducting community patrols of ICE agents in their neighborhood. This is a clip from a patrol in May. They speak in English and Spanish.
Hemlock. Mm-hmm. Parece unos vehículos sospechosos.
Aquí está, they're in front of us.
Sí, 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 los vemos. Oh. Estamos frente a ustedes. ¿Qué vehículos, más o menos?
Son tres vehículos.
One of the people helping on these patrols by Union del Barrio is Adriana Hasso, who will join us in a minute. This is a clip of her on another patrol using a bullhorn to alert the community that ICE agents are on site. She speaks in Spanish.
Aquí tenemos ICE. Cierra. Cierra.
For more, we're joined in San Diego by Adriana Hasso, immigration and human rights advocate with the longtime group Union del Barrio. Welcome to Democracy Now, Adriana. It's great to have you with us. So we are describing these different stories. Can you tell us first what happened on Friday at this Italian eatery? It was just opening up. Armed, heavily armed ICE agents, various immigration parts of the government move in, and tell us what happened and then how the community is responding.
Thank you, Amy, for the invitation. It's a pleasure to be with you. Yes, on Friday evening around 5 p.m., as members of the community of South Park, which is a middle class community and one of the many communities in San Diego, was getting ready for dinner. And this particular restaurant has been popular for many years by local families and people who are just about to enjoy an evening of family time. And on Friday, HSI, the investigative branch of CBP of DHS came to that location and requested for customers to exit the restaurant, as well as put under arrest and detention to every person working and serving a function in the restaurant.
And could you tell us, Adriana, in terms of this move toward actual raids, rather than just going into arrest individual peoples, which the Trump administration started, but now raids in the community, how frequently have these begun to crop up?
Yes, thank you, Dr. Gonzalez. We have seen an increase in the level of fear, intimidation, and terror that our communities are experiencing. We have had a clear escalation of work raids, and including this latest one at this restaurant. At the end of March, a construction site was raided in the East County of El Cajon, and the images and the level of escalation and aggression and excessive use of force, intimidation, and terror that some of the images showed in South Park do not compare to what we saw and witnessed in the city of El Cajon, wherein over 80 agents exercised an operation at a work site that lasted 6.5 hours, and they detained over 200 workers with the conclusion of taking into custody 17 of those over 100 workers that they detained for over 6 hours.
And what about the situation of farm workers? The rest, the whole nation, not just California, depends on the work of farm workers in California. Many of them are immigrant workers. What's the situation that you've been able to tell of in the fields?
Specifically to the community in the county of Bakersfield and the Central Valley, where most of the food comes from and is cared for and harvested by the hands and the labor of migrant workers and workers of Latino, Mexicano descent, as well as Central America. We have had two major work rates or targeting farm workers in the Bakersfield early mid-December, and a second one that had an impact took place to the in the farm workers community in the Orange County as well, in the Orange County about a month ago. This is has been the escalation of targeting. And this came from Border Patrol, another branch of CBP, where over 100 workers were detained. The first operation, and the second one, over 20 workers were detained. What is particular to highlight is that many of the workers were able to exercise and defend themselves from the excessive use of force and the abusive psychological harm that border agents and ICE agents were trying to inflict at the time of the interaction with the workers.
So if you can talk, Adriana Hasso, about how the community is organizing. We're seeing communities where a sudden arrest happens and just the community rises up from Missouri to Massachusetts. But you've been organizing for years. How are you moving on now? What are people doing in their organizing as Stephen Miller talks about ramping up to 3,000 arrests to each day?
We understand and have adhered to our historical responsibility to fight back, to resist, and to denounce and take the moral imperative to say that the legal framework, due process, constitutional rights, civil rights, human rights that were protection to our communities and to the working class of the West and every in other places in the country, this administration has made sure to erase and to try to attack and violate every human right, every constitutional right. Unión del Barrio stands in very much the assessment and the understanding that we have the responsibility to defend our communities. We are organizing night and day, weekend, weekdays, every single possible energy and time that we are able to put into community work and say that we have the right and the responsibility to defend ourselves. You had a chance to see the community patrols that we have in place from LA, from Riverside, from San Diego, from Escondido, and we're developing relationships to implement this model in Santa Barbara and San Francisco, and also potentially looking at growing in places like Utah, New York, Chicago. We are having those conversations because we know and we understand that the moral imperative to fight back, to resist, and to not ask for permission or apologize for the right to exist. These are exciting times, yet they are difficult times, painful times, but this is also could be an opportunity for the movement to gain the strength to stand up and face a fascistic, harmful government that has done away with the fundamental human rights and constitutional rights that we as communities deserve.
Adriana Hasso, I want to thank you for being with us, immigration and human rights advocate based in San Diego, California, a member of Unión del Barrio. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. President Trump is pushing Republican senators to back his what he calls Big Beautiful Bill, which includes key funding to carry out his administration's agenda of arresting as many as 3,000 immigrants and asylum seekers a day, then jail them until their deportation. The bill includes more than $150 billion in additional funding to hire new ICE agents and add detention space. ICE has already signed new agreements with jails around the country. This comes as many high-profile student activists facing deportation have been transferred to ICE jails in Louisiana, and the family of a New York City high school student from Venezuela who was recently detained at his immigration court date say he was shuttled between four different states in 5 days, New Jersey, Texas, Louisiana, and Pennsylvania. Immigrants have protested poor conditions at the ICE jails, many of which are run by private prison companies like Geo Group and Core Civic. On Sunday, activists joined La Resistencia for a solidarity day outside Northwest Detention Center run by Geo Group in Tacoma, Washington.
We know that when we fight for a single migrant, it is not just about freeing all detained migrants, but about ending the root causes of forced migration, the abolition of all systems that lead to deportations.
This comes as ICE confirmed there's been 9 deaths in custody since President Trump took office. For more, we're joined by Detention Watch Network Executive Director Silky Shah, author of the book Unbuild Walls, Why Immigrant Justice Needs Abolition. Silky, welcome back to Democracy Now! It's great to have you with us. Describe where people are being brought to, what this detention network, as the Trump administration says they're cutting costs, they're doing it to pay for tax breaks for the rich. They are massively increasing the Homeland Security and ICE budget.
Yeah, I mean, when the detention system is sprawling, people are detained in every single part of the country. There has been a massive expansion of detention for years, and now what we're seeing under President Trump is even more expansion, which could be even that much more exponential if this budget bill passes. And it really feels like a paradigm-shifting moment. After 9/11, we saw so much more money funneled into the system, into border security, into immigrant detention, and the detention system doubled. We're in that situation again, where now the numbers are reaching close to 50,000, which is what it was back in 2019. People are being packed into overcrowded cells. People are not getting medical care. They're in conditions where they're languishing, and they're doing everything they can to expand, both here in the U.S. and also seeing people be now detained in third countries abroad.
Yeah, Silky, I wanted to ask you about that, this offshoring of detention by the Trump administration through third-party countries. To what extent do you see that growing as well? And of course, there are continue to be legal battles over the constitutionality of doing that.
Yeah, I mean, I think the thing to remember is that the U.S. has the largest immigration detention system in the world, largely because the U.S. has the largest prison system in the world. So U.S. policy is always focused on detaining people here, especially those people who are coming to the border, who are or currently live here and are being detained and are in deportation proceedings. But across the world, many countries actually detain people in other locations, Australia, England, I mean, the UK, Israel, other places have done this. And so it's not totally unprecedented. It is really concerning to see the U.S. move in this direction while at the same time building up the detention capacity here. So we need to make sure that we're doing the work to say, no, it's not okay to transfer people offshore, but not normalize the detention that's growing here more and more in county jails and private prison companies and all these other types of spaces, military bases, the use of Bureau of Prison facilities. We're seeing expansion in so many levels.
And what about this tactic of effectively disappearing people who have been detained by constantly transferring them from one ICE detention facility to another so that their family members and lawyers have trouble even finding them?
This is actually nothing new. We've seen this for years in ICE detention where people are constantly transferred, sometimes because of retaliation, because people might be organizing on this inside, sometimes because of capacity concerns, because, and often to, like you were saying, you know, to disrupt their experience and get them to sign away their rights and be deported because they are no longer near family or no longer near counsel or in these remote detention centers that don't have medical care. The conditions are terrible. So it's a tactic that's been used for a very long time. And what we've seen over time as the detention system has ballooned and in these moments when it's really heightened, transfers are much more rampant and it's much more disruptive to the system.
Talk about the Democrats' response to what's happening.
I mean, I think what's so frustrating about the sort of what we are seeing right now is that for months, especially last year, there was much enabling. I mean, Harris ran a campaign where she was positioning herself as more hardline than Trump on this issue, leading to the passage of the Laken Riley Act in January, which actually expanded mandatory detention, the most we've seen in 30 years. And so really what's so frustrating is that the Democrats have really capitulated on this issue. And now we're seeing many more members of Congress doing unannounced inspections of facilities, which is great to see. But we really need to make sure this budget bill doesn't pass and make sure that leaders say, no, we don't want to balloon the system. I mean, it would mean $45 billion more for immigrant detention, 13 times what the budget is currently. So, you know, detention facilitates deportation, and their goal is to expand so that they can scale up the number of deportations.
And what about the Trump administration's use of detention to basically to repress political dissent, especially in relationship to the war in Gaza? You wrote a piece for Truth Out. Khalil case shows how migrant justice and Palestine solidarity are tied together.
Yeah, I mean, I think the reality is that the immigration detention system has become a testing ground for authoritarianism. And so you're seeing that in the case of the student detentions, where you have people being targeted essentially for thought crimes. But the thing that we have to understand is that for 30 years, many immigrants have been denied due process because of their interactions with the criminal legal system or because they're newly arriving. And so this is really building on many, many years of expanding mandatory detention, including for people who have green cards and people who are legal permanent residents. And so that's not necessarily new. But then to move and say they're going to go after people for thought crimes, and particularly, and part of the reason I wrote that piece is to say, you know, the immigrant justice fight is an internationalist fight. We have to understand that U.S. foreign policy plays a huge role in the reason why that people are migrating. And we have to see that, you know, the people who are on the receiving end of that are people who are being targeted here, whether they're Palestinians or people who support Palestinians or Haitians or Venezuelans or other communities that have been on the receiving end of U.S. foreign policy. And it's so important for us to really think about our work as understanding the root causes and the role that U.S. foreign policy plays in migration right now.
Well, Silke Shah, I want to thank you so much for being with us, Executive Director of Detention Watch Network, author of the book Unbuild Walls, Why Immigrant Justice Needs Abolition. Coming up, we look at how Palantir, Peter Thiel's company, is helping DOGE build a master database to surveil and track immigrants. Stay with us.
Pero no que me querías. ser solo la empleada.
Honduran musician Carla Lara performing in our Democracy Now! Studio. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. We end today's show looking at how the Trump administration has tapped Palantir, the data mining company founded by the billionaire tech investor Peter Thiel, to compile data on people in the United States for a master database, including a new $30 million contract with ICE to provide near real-time visibility into migrant movements as it seeks to arrest 3,000 people a day. We're joined right now here in New York by McKenna Kelly, senior writer at Wired, where her recent articles are headlined, Doge is building a master database to surveil and track immigrants. And also, Doge is busier than ever. And Trump says Elon Musk is really not leaving. So if you can lay out what we know about this master database and Palantir's contracts with ICE, and let's be clear, we just mentioned Musk leaving, but actually not really, right? Musk and Thiel founded PayPal together, these two billionaire bros, tech bros, and now Thiel's company, Palantir, what it's doing.
Yeah, sure. So just a few months ago, we started hearing about databases within DHS and IRS, SSA, across government being linked together. The purpose at the time was very unclear, but from my reporting and reporting that I've done with my colleague Victoria Elliott, we've learned that it seems as if this is a process to mix data from government agencies that immigrants often report to, so IRS and tax data, all these kinds of things that can track their most recent addresses and things like that, into one database that already, you know, USCIS has a tremendous amount of data on anyone seeking, you know, any kind of to immigrate into this country. And so the Palantir process with its software Foundry basically becomes the window for all of this data and allows folks at DHS and maybe even at other agencies, we're not quite sure yet, to submit queries and to find information and link it together about folks all across the country.
And what kind of checks are there on this merging of data systems?
Yeah, it's a great question. I mean, at this point, we don't really know for sure what the checks are. In some cases, these contracts haven't even been signed yet. And it's a big, it's a big idea that is playing out within agencies, individual agencies. So we've seen it, this unification of data process happening at IRS. There's been some discussion about bringing it to SSA and DHS. But it's still very much cropping up in individual agencies, and we haven't really heard exactly if there is some kind of master plan and how that could be regulated and what oversight would look like in this case.
And for those people who are not familiar with Peter Thiel and his Palantir technologies, could you talk a little bit about his history and viewpoints? I mean, there was one article that said that he's a big believer in Armageddon and he has insisted that the enemies of the West will prevail unless software developers work more closely with the American government to produce AI-powered military capabilities.
Sure. Yeah. So Peter Thiel got his start, you know, decades ago during the dot-com boom with Elon Musk and David Sachs, many people who are now in the government. David Sachs now is this AI czar at in the White House. And so they made a ton of money building PayPal. And Peter Thiel has gone on to become a venture capitalist, investing in a ton of companies and co-founding Palantir, which he still interacts with and knows Alex Karp, the CEO, fairly well. Palantir, you were discussing like how Peter Thiel was talking about American exceptionalism and wanting to become a most, you know, a tremendously dominant military power. Palantir is the company to do that. It is the company that builds a tremendous amount of defense and military technologies in order to use drones to track people across the world for American military operations. And so we're seeing Palantir being brought not just in the military industry, but also the public industry across a bunch of different agencies, as well as just different companies and businesses as well. They're starting to change not just from defense spending, right, but into becoming an operation system for the entire government.
So let's talk about how this all works. We all have these images of the last few months of these young DOGE workers going into various agencies, sometimes forcing their way in, sometimes with police, and moving right into the area where they can download or whatever it is they do with these databases, essentially, as you're reporting, to centralize them. How does a private company get access to these databases? I also want to ask you, over the past few weeks, you reported this in April, DOGE leadership within the IRS orchestrated a hackathon aimed at plotting out a mega API allowing privileged users to view all agency data from a central access point. Sources tell Wired the project will likely be hosted on Foundry, as you were describing the software that was developed by Palantir. Talk more about this.
Yeah.
They get access and hand it to a private company?
Yeah, so this is done across government with Amazon Web Services, Google, all kinds of different tech contractors are able to access this kind of data to build services for it. What you just discussed with IRS, this Palantir process and this creating a giant centralized database of, American civil data was something.
Meanwhile, all these workers are getting fired.
Exactly.
But they keep their information.
Right. At the beginning of the Trump administration, you had folks at the General Services Administration, people who are associated with Elon Musk, the husband of someone who worked at XAI and X.com, and then also Thomas Shedd, who is leading things over there, who is an ex-Tesla engineer. They said that their main goal for this administration was to centralize data all across government. Centralizing data is incredibly difficult, especially with the mass amounts of data that the federal government has on everyone, living and working within the United States. And so it seems as if this process has shifted instead of building one giant database, right, but to unifying data at every single agency. So we're seeing that in my reporting at IRS. They're unifying all the data there to make it more easily accessible and accessed. And then also, if you have a Foundry system at IRS and have one at DHS, those can talk to each other incredibly easily, which means you don't necessarily have to centralize all that data. You're able to query a variety of data systems across government if these systems are interoperable, which it looks like they could be.
And what about this issue of gaining access to the ITIN numbers of that are often used by immigrants instead of Social Security numbers?
Yeah, so the IRS has a tremendous amount of data on anyone who reports income, right? And so IRS data is really, really important because it has oftentimes the most recent addresses for workers in the country. So if you're trying to find someone who is operating in the, who's trying to become a United States citizen, who has applied and done the USCIS online portal, oftentimes, even if they move around, right, the IRS will have the most recent data on how to locate them. And that is why this system is could be incredibly powerful if it plays out the way that we expect it to.
And in the last seconds, we have playing around with voter rolls?
Yes. That was something that I was able to find in my reporting at IRS. It sounds as if, from the sources who spoke to me, that they were able to download voting data from countries and from states, including Pennsylvania and Florida. Antonio Gracias, who is a close friend to Elon Musk, is running that operation at SSA. And even in a recent podcast, he said that they were able to, cross-reference data within SSA and voting record data across, the country in order to identify folks who may have voted illegally. Now, we don't really have a lot of information from what they found because I doubt they found much. But this is the kinds of ways that they're using our data.
Well, McKenna Kelly, there's so much to talk about. I want to thank you for doing this work as senior writer at Wired. We'll link to your recent articles on DOGE, Palantir, and Elon Musk, Peter Thiel, and others. That does it for our show. We're hiring senior headline news producer, a director of audience, and a director of technology, all full-time jobs. Check it out at democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
Hi, my name is Lowell, and you're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, Simon Fraser Campus Radio.
Would you give me a beat?
CJSF 90.1 FM is the campus radio station for Simon Fraser University, located on Burnaby Mountain in BC, Canada. CJSF 90.1 FM, diverse, independent, yours. Check us out on SoundCloud or at cjsf.ca.